Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and there are two fabulous DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are by a dear friend of Real Science Radio, Spike Pisaris. And Spike has created simply the greatest astronomy DVDs ever produced. And we have gone through probably hundreds of science DVDs and books, and we recommend only the very best at our store, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and you'll love these astronomy DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. You got to get them.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. One of our favorite topics is the age of the Earth. Our list of not-so-old things uses hard science to expose errors in claims of millions and billions of years. For example, carbon-14 only lasts thousands of years, not millions. Yet it's found in surprisingly large quantities everywhere it's not supposed to be, like deep in mines within the Earth, in coal, oil, gas, and even in dinosaur bones and diamonds. Dr. Paul Giem, longtime assistant professor at Loma Linda University of Emergency Medicine. Dr. Giem majored in chemistry at Union College before becoming an MD, a medical doctor. Dr. Giem has long researched carbon-14. So for us here at Real Science Radio, to get Dr. Giem as a professor to evaluate and grade our work on carbon-14, well, that'd be exciting. Dr. Giem, welcome to Real Science Radio. What makes for a passing grade, doctor, in carbon-14?
Well, that all depends on what you're going to be graded as. Mm-hmm. You know, you grade high school students a little more leniently, college a little tougher, and graduate school really tough.
Wow. Okay.
All right. Where do you want to go from there?
Part of me wants to say go easy on us, but really I want to know the hard truth. So be tough on us, all right?
Okay, we'll do that.
So we have an article that I know you have reviewed for this program at our Real Science Radio website. If somebody goes to our website and just adds /carbon-14 or /14C, however they want to put it, they'll come to our article about carbon-14 and dinosaur bones. So would it be all right for you and I to work through this and you critique what we've been presenting?
It sure would.
Okay, great. How would you like to proceed? Do you have it in front of you, Dr. Giem?
I do.
Great.
Let's just start at the top and note issues as we go down.
Okay.
And then at the end, we'll try to sum it up and to try to summarize the material you have.
Yes.
Let's start with the three related lines of evidence showing up the young Earth interpretation.
All right.
And you have dinosaur soft tissue, unracemized left-handed amino acids, and carbon-14. And those are all good arguments. Of course, the details have to be fleshed out as to how we know for sure that it is carbon-14, for example, whether amino acids absolutely prove what you want to prove, or are they indications, or are they really not worth much at all?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the dinosaur soft tissue is a huge area of controversy with arguments over, A, whether it's there, and B, whether it should be there if there have been millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
So let's dive into the details of the carbon-14 area, which is the area you're discussing in particular here.
Yes.
And we'll kind of incidentally talk about the left-handed amino acids as well. The issue of soft tissue, I think, we'll leave for somebody else to look at.
Sure thing.
So, first of all, I am very, very careful about saying anything that is absolute, because science doesn't usually deal in absolutes. Now, that's not to say some people don't think it does.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we get that from the other side, but that doesn't mean we need to copy them. So when you say undermine, I would rather say at present argue against, knowing that the argument could change in the future. And that way we're not claiming absolute knowledge as to whether it undermines or not.
You have a book you've written on scientific theology. Is that a theme of your book? Or is that at least covered in your book, this caution?
This kind of caution. Whenever you're dealing with science, you have to be careful, because things that were thought to be absolutely known have turned out not to be correct. Now, most of the time they've been turned out to be mostly correct, but the biggest example, and the one that's caused the most difficulties in philosophy of science, was the fact that Newton turned out not to be right after 300 years of people thinking he had it nailed down to as far as you want to go in decimal places.
Yeah, so Newtonian physics gave way to relativity and Albert
Einstein.
That's
right, and nobody's going to say now that relativity won't give way to something else if we refine it to a certain point.
Now, what you're saying is stated by the vast majority of scientists working in the creation movement, and I think a lot of the secular scientists also. It gets us off of carbon 14, but just make an observation that maybe it challenges that widespread claim. When we say that science can't tell us anything absolutely, do we tend to be focused on extreme detail in minutiae, whereas if we were to broaden our perspective to look at a bigger picture, perhaps science can tell us things absolutely. Like, for example, if we make statements about the temperature of the sun and the temperature of objects beyond Pluto, or empty space versus the inside of a star, can't science tell us, can't we be confident that the sun is hotter, let's say, than the surface of Neptune? Can't we say those things with absolute certainty?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so I'm always a little bit confused about how to draw the line, like say from Answers in Genesis or CMI. I love these groups, but they make that statement and it seems to me it needs to be qualified a little bit.
Here's what has to happen. In science, the best way to do it is, rather than to make absolute statement, is to let the evidence speak for itself. Mm. And most people will, let's say, not send anybody to the sun for an exploratory visit, because I think rightly they figure that that would be a suicide mission.
Yes.
And probably not accomplish anything.
Yes, we Christians are against suicide, so.
Whereas if one is going to explore, say, Mars, one is going to have to be prepared for extreme cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Besides all of the other difficulties of going to Mars, such as getting radiated on the way.
Right.
And so there comes a point where scientists do kind of close the books and say, yeah, you know, really, this is the way it is. But they have been fooled.
Yes.
And they have been fooled in important ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument that I think we're making right now is that the majority of scientists have been fooled in terms of the age of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. So that at present, it seems that this data argues against the view that these things are millions of years old.
That's correct.
Okay.
But we need to be respectful of people who say, no, not really, but rather ask them, well, what evidence do you have that suggests that?
Hmm.
I think that's the appropriate approach rather than saying, you guys are just ignoring our evidence.
All right. That's a lesson in manners, and we appreciate that here at Real Science Radio. That's important.
Okay. Well, let's go on down. Carbon 14 and dinosaurs at the American Geophysical Conference in Singapore. That is a fascinating subject, and your paragraph has got it pretty well down, actually.
Oh, wow.
That and the next one. You know, I recommend people look at that. That has implications not only for the data itself, but also for the scientific community's attitudes towards that kind of data.
Mm-hmm. And if I could describe that to the audience, they're not looking at it. Some of them are driving in their cars right now, so please don't pull this up on your iPhone. Keep your eyes on the road. But just for the sake of the audience, this was a presentation at a geophysical conference in Singapore last summer, and they did carbon dating on the bones of 10 dinosaurs from around the world, different respected labs, and they found significant quantities of radiocarbon that is carbon-14, which should only last thousands of years, not millions. This is a significant find, and it seems to be a consistent find.
That's correct. And the people who ran the conference took it out of the schedule after it had been presented because they said there's something wrong with the data, even though they didn't know what it was that was wrong, or in fact, if anything was wrong, but it just conflicted with their view of how old things should be. And so obviously it had to be wrong because it had the wrong perspective. But of course, if the question is, well, what perspective should we choose, then ruling it out of court to begin with is an improper procedure.
And this was a conference sponsored in part by the American Geophysical Union. And from another interview I did with one of these scientists on this team, the president of the AGU went to the hotel room of one of the presenters at a different conference in San Francisco and basically sat and received the presentation privately. You know, the data, what they've done here is they removed it from the program rather than attempt to respond to the data.
That's correct.
All right.
Now, to move on, the point that you make that since carbon-14 is everywhere, it can't be an anomaly. You know, at a certain point, this is a massive anomaly, or it actually starts becoming expected, and then you have to explain it not as just something weird, but as something that challenges your theory. And I think it's starting to get to the point where that's what's going on, which is, of course, I think why the people who ran the American Geophysical Union meeting decided to take it out of the meeting, because it's easier not to deal with it if it's not officially true. But this is an important point. The peer-reviewed literature is not always quite what it's cracked up to be because there's a filter in the way.
Okay, now, Dr. Giem, let me, again, for the sake of the audience, just summarize the last point that I presented here, that carbon-14 seems to be everywhere. It's no longer an anomaly because it's expected. And as has been reported in science journals, secular journals, and creationist journals, and elsewhere, carbon-14 has been found in natural gas, in fossil wood, coal, marble, dinosaur bones, and even supposedly billion-year-old diamonds, where the carbon-14 only lasts for thousands of years. So then the evolutionist makes a secondary assumption, and they say, well, since we're finding carbon-14, say, in diamonds and dinosaur bones, and we know it couldn't have been there originally because it would have all been gone, it would have all decayed, therefore it must be either contamination, like, say, groundwater bringing bacteria into the specimen, or they say it might be neutron capture. Could you explain to the audience what neutron capture would mean?
What neutron capture is there are certain reactions that if a neutron hits, for example, a carbon-13 and gets absorbed, that carbon-13 now becomes carbon-14. If a neutron hits nitrogen-14, a very interesting reaction takes place where the nitrogen-14 spits out a proton on the other side and becomes carbon-14.
And the way that
it's called an NP reaction, it's a bit unusual, but there are a few other ones around. The important thing is this is the one that actually creates carbon-14 in the atmosphere. Cosmic rays strike nitrogen-14. And then cause the nitrogen-14 to lose a proton and absorb the neutron and become carbon-14. And there's about 22 pounds a year, more or less, that are made in the atmosphere that way.
And that's the normal production of carbon-14 in the world. And then plants and animals, they breathe in the atmosphere and they get this radiocarbon, this radioactive carbon that then decays with a half-life of about 5,700 years. But let's say you have uranium or thorium in a mine, and that stuff is radioactive, so you're going to have neutrons that are going to strike atoms in the surrounding material, and so you could have the production of carbon-14 in the crust of the Earth, and that's what they call neutron capture.
That's correct.
So we argue here on this carbon 14 page that if you want to say that all the carbon 14 in coal, oil, gas, diamonds, dinosaur bones, if you want to say it's from neutron capture, well, there are some challenges you're going to have to address. So should we look at some of those?
Well, first, carbon 14 is found in specimens worldwide, yet the production in the ground is very, very low. There aren't really enough neutrons, and that's kind of the bottom line. The people who make this proposal have never done the math that is required to figure out how much carbon-14 should be produced by neutrons. Mm. In a sense, this is really a defensive maneuver. That is to say, these people aren't really looking for the answer. They're looking for an appropriate answer that will allow them to ignore the implications of the data. Because if you were looking for the answer, then you'd do some preliminary calculations as to how many neutrons there are, and people have done that, and it turns out to be thousands of times too few neutrons, even in uranium-rich material, to produce the kind of effect that they need.
Wow. So obviously, not every coal bed on Earth is rich in uranium.
That's correct.
In fact, I linked to a USGS report that indicates that radioactivity is relatively scarce, even in the continental crust, where most of it is on the Earth. It's not an answer. It's more like a rescue device, I think, as Dr. Jason Lyle might call it, to say, well, it comes from neutron capture. There simply isn't enough radioactive material in all of these places all over the Earth to produce all this carbon-14 in situ in the specimen. So,
yes.
So that's the first argument we're making against it, which is related to the second.
And the second is basically a continuation of the first. Radioactivity is relatively scarce in the continental crust. Now, one of the things that would be interesting would be to do carbon-14 dates on material that was in relatively uranium-poor environments and in relatively uranium-rich environments, because the amount of carbon-14 should be proportional to the amount of uranium in the surrounding material. I haven't seen anybody actually do that.
Well, and we're going to come to a point I make soon, the fourth point, that maybe would suggest that those results will not be helpful to the evolutionist who wants to say that this carbon-14 is from neutron capture.
I'm an experimentalist, so what I prefer to do is to say, rather than I don't think it'll help, I'd say let's do it and see whether it helps.
Let's go do it. A good experiment is worth a thousand theories, as Dr. Walt Brown likes to point out. And yeah, going to find out, we propose on this single page on carbon-14, we propose a number of experiments and research projects, and that would be a great one.
So going to number three, this mentions that there's less than 20 parts per million of uranium in the dinosaur bones that contributed large quantities of modern carbon. And then it says uranium mines where the uranium content is 18% yield carbon specimens which have 1% carbon-14. That would be a surprise to me because 1% is literally 10 billion times as much as the carbon-14 in the biosphere itself. I would want to have a reference for that particular assertion, and I suspect that what it really should read is less than 1% of the usual level of carbon-14.
Yes.
So that's okay. One that I would probably...
All right, we're going to get that marked off in our grade. I can see it coming. Okay.
Now let's move on to number four.
Yep. Which, by the way, that's going to make our overall argument stronger. There is an error there, but it's sort of an error in our favor in a sense.
That is true.
Dr. Geem, our fourth point is we had a meeting with a geologist who graduated from the Colorado School of Mines right up the road from us. He has a background in nuclear physics. He spent years in industry. His job was to bombard various elements with neutrons to make isotopes for sale. And he told Real Science Radio that carbon doesn't readily absorb neutrons, and that it's the heavier elements, beginning with sodium, that readily captures neutrons. So he sort of intuitively dismissed the idea that this is nitrogen and carbon capturing neutrons. He said that's just not going to happen all that readily in nature.
You know, for carbon, that's true. The cross-section in barns for carbon is about 1/1000th of a barn.
Mm. A barn, people I don't think will recognize.
A barn is a kind of a joking reference to, wow, that nucleus is as big as a barn.
Yeah, that guy can't hit the broadside of a barn with that gun.
Yeah, exactly. And when you realize that it's 10 to the minus 32 square meters, we're talking about a very, very small cross-sectional area.
Mm.
But the point is, there are some heavier elements that have thousands of barns across, gadolinium and cadmium being the other one, to the most extreme examples. But in fact, nitrogen-14 has a fairly decent cross-section, and that's why it absorbs most of the neutrons in the atmosphere. Nitrogen has a 1.8 barn, depending on who you read, 1.7, 1.9 I've seen quoted, but it's a substantial size compared with carbon. Carbon is relatively small, and they're right about that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what I would want to do is, rather than saying, I just don't think so, I want to say, here are the calculations. Here are how many neutrons there are. Here are how much carbon there is. How do you get there?
Mm-hmm.
Just simply saying, I don't think it'll work, is probably not a really good argument, especially if you have somebody who's skeptical on the other side.
And this meeting, it was informal, so I can't exactly cite the geologist. He works in industry to this day. But his point was that they typically started with silicon and on up in order to do their neutron capture. But you're saying that nitrogen would be, you think, a sufficient target, with your evidence being in the upper atmosphere. That's how we're creating 22 pounds a year of carbon-14.
That's correct.
Okay.
The problem with nitrogen is not so much that nitrogen won't do it, it's that there are not enough neutrons. And so what you want to do is you want to calculate, well, how many neutrons do we have? How many neutrons do we need to get the levels we have now? And if it's 1,000th or 1/10,000th or 100,000th of the amount that we need, obviously we're not going to get there. And that really kind of supervenes having to say, well, I don't think so.
Right.
So although it's a kind of a decent argument, a better argument would be to have actual numbers attached to it.
Okay, and I think I could see now that the last sentence in that fourth point should be stricken. In fact, you sort of address it from a different angle, you yourself. I quote a Dr. Paul Giem in this article, and that's you, so it's such an honor to be speaking with you, Paul. But I think the last sentence needs to be stricken from that point, because it's maybe a good argument with carbon, but not a good argument with nitrogen.
That is correct.
Okay, so we'll strike the last sentence. And then it's too late to submit this for regrading, so we're just going to have to bear with the results. All right, now we're up to the fifth point. Could you address that?
The fifth point, of course, is quoting myself, which is that since nitrogen-14 captures neutrons 110,000 times more easily than it does carbon-13, now I'm going to have to say that I redid those calculations before we went on the air, just to be sure. And they are correct, except that you have to understand how they're done. Unfortunately, if they're read naively, they can be misleading. And so I have to give myself a little bit of a ding on this because of not being clear.
All right.
What I should have said is, since nitrogen in a carbonaceous material captures neutrons 110 times more easily than does carbon-13 to produce carbon-14. Hmm. That's a lot more complicated, but let me explain what I mean by that.
Yes.
Nitrogen, as I said, has a cross-section of somewhere around 1.8 barns. Carbon-13 has a cross-section of about a little over 1 millibarn. That's 1/1000th of a barn. So that nitrogen actually absorbs neutrons only about 2,000 times more, not 110,000.
Mm.
But where the extra comes in is that nitrogen is 99.636% nitrogen-14. Basically, it's 100% nitrogen-14.
Right.
Whereas carbon is only about 1%, 1.07% carbon-13. And so if you have carbon,
I see what you're saying.
Only 1% of it, a little over, can actually turn into carbon 14 if you hit it with nitrogen. The carbon 12 will either leave the neutrons bounce off, or else it will absorb it and turn to carbon 13, which won't get you what you need.
So could we do this after this program, Dr. Giem? Could I work with you, or you send us a couple sentences that clarifies this point for the sake of the audience, and then we'll post that? That would be an honor, because we're breaking new ground here. We're about out of time. Could I present the last point? And then if you would, we would like to continue this with a second program. Would that be possible, Dr.
Giem? That would be possible.
Well, great. The sixth point comes from Dr. Jonathan Sarfati. Actually, I believe he's quoting another scientist who said that if we're going to explain the carbon-14 in coal as resulting from neutron capture, there'd have to be so much uranium there that we wouldn't call it coal, we'd call it uranium. What I'd like to do, since we are out of time, is maybe we'll pick up with that point, and then in the next program, Dr. Giem will go into the claim that this is all from contamination, that it's groundwater and bacteria and all seeping into these specimens. So thank you so much for your time. It's really been fun. A little fear and trepidation here on my part, but thank you, Dr. Giem.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
All right. And our website will point to Dr. Giem's website and his videos, which are fascinating. That's realscienceradio.com. I am Bob Enyart for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner, on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist? Bob Enyart Debates Atheist Zaketh, a Psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the Earth, where I got to debate a mathematician and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realscienceradio.com. This is Bob Enyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.